A very good Monday. Welcome to today's edition of the Maya Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In addition to feature agricultural news reports, I'll bring you national and regional agricultural news headlines. And I'll start with regional ag news right after this.
AgroPlante is the leading manufacturer in specialty products. AgroPlante formulates products that rise to the challenge of today's growing conditions. Saline and sodic soils reduce crop yield and cause significant crop losses. AgroPlante developed Cation EX5 Plus with growers in mind to manage soil salinity. With multiple years of research, Cation EX5 Plus has proven to be an excellent source of calcium and an effective soil salinity manager. Run it through drip irrigation without any issues. Simplify your application method with innovative and efficient formulations. Alleviate salinity stress with Cation EX5 Plus. AgroPlante, imagination, innovation, science in action.
Supplies of organic celery will be limited until likely mid-June. The historically cold and rainy winter in California has caused significant supply issues of celery for the industry, including blight, cedar, and planting gaps, according to Brian Amaral of Braga Fresh Family Farms and Josie's Organics. In addition, Braga Fresh has a transitional celery program in Santa Maria scheduled to begin this month that is delayed by 3 weeks. Finally, in mid-June, the Salinas region will commence with its regular production and better yields of organic celery. Amaral adds that Braga Fresh Family Farms has seen an increased demand for organic celery as it moves to this year's transitional period for celery supplies. He also says that in turn, the prices look to remain strong, and he believes they will keep climbing until mid-June when that normal volume begins in Salinas. Scientists at the University of California, Irvine have made a remarkable discovery about cellophane bees. Their microbiomes are some of the most primitive known from the insect world. These bees, which are named for their use of cellophane-like materials to line their subterranean nests, are known for their fascinating behaviors and their important ecological roles as pollinators. Now researchers have uncovered another aspect of their biology that makes them even more intriguing. According to a study published in Frontiers in Microbiology, cellophane bees brew a liquid food for their offspring held in chambers called brood cells. The microbiome of these brood cells is dominated by lactobacilli bacteria, which are known for their role in fermenting foods like yogurt, sauerkraut, and sourdough bread. These researchers found that these bacteria are highly active in the food provisions of cellophane bees, where they likely play an important role as a source of nutrients for developing larvae. This discovery is quite remarkable, according to Tobin Hammer, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology and lead author. He says they know that lactobacilli are important for fermentation of food, but finding wild bees that use them essentially the same way was really surprising. Most of the 20,000 species of bees get their nutrition from nectar and pollen, but for these cellophane bees, they suspect the lactobacilli are really important. They have effectively evolved from herbivores into omnivores. The study also found that the food provisions of cellophane bees have much higher bacterial biomass compared to other bee species, matching the unusually fermentive smell that comes from their brood cells. This uniquely rich lactobacilli-dominated microbreweries of cellophane bees could have important implications for the health of bees, as well as for the ecology of the ecosystems in which they live. The study highlights the importance of studying the microbiomes of insects, which are often overlooked, in favor of more familiar animals like birds and mammals, despite playing an enormous role in ecosystems in the world over. By understanding the complex interactions between microbes and their insect hosts, scientists can gain new insights into the biology of these important animals and the ecosystems that they inhabit. The study was a collaboration between researchers at Cornell University, the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, University of California, Riverside, Colorado State University, and the University of Arizona. The National Science Foundation, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Simmons Foundation provided support. Limoneria is launching its new Catch the Citrus Wave campaign, which features a playful packaging design capturing the essence of a day at the beach with colorful citrus characters. This year, the company has added limes to the campaign, and consumers can now enjoy the spirit of summer with lemon, lime, orange, and mandarin bags. Each bag features a playful design that highlights a variety and catches a playful spirit of summer activities. Bags have a QR code, which takes people to their landing page, featuring a variety of recipes, games, coloring activities, and sustainable farming initiatives, according to Susan Jones-Negg, Director of International Sales and Citrus Marketing. Limoneria is also hosting a summer social media sweepstakes from May through August, where consumers can win a prize. The company's Instagram page also features beach-themed swag. Patagonia Food LLC of San Luis Obispo, California is recalling certain frozen blackberries because of a possible hepatitis A contamination. According to the company recall posted by the Food and Drug Administration, the recall was initiated March 17th and is ongoing. There is a concern that consumers may have the frozen fruit in their home freezers. The recalled blackberries were distributed in California, Oregon, Nebraska, Texas, Washington, and Nevada.
The recent weather roller coaster, marked by 90-degree temperatures followed by cold and rain, really started late last year. And Mel Machado, Blue Diamond Growers Vice President of Member Relations, said all of the strange weather has added yet another layer of uncertainty to this year's almond crop.
The roller coaster of weather, if you go back through December, we had a series of warm storms. As I recall, it was 9 of the atmospheric rivers, as they call them, that were warm, that accelerated development, or at least it looked like it was accelerating the pace of development. And I'm thinking, okay, this crop's not going to be late. Not sure how early it's going to be, but it's not going to be late. And then we got into cold air, and everything came to a screeching halt. The bloom development slowed down to a crawl. We had a lot of rain, as everybody remembers. We had wind. We had literally 8 days of no bee activity because it was cold and wet and windy. And development slowed down, and as I said, just slowed to a virtual crawl or a stop. And so the post-bloom period wasn't much better, and we wound up with a situation of, okay, how are we going to get a crop out of this? And as you drive around and you look around the valley, you think, wow, we actually have a crop. How do we do this? But the crop varies pretty dramatically, depending on where you're at, which orchards you're looking at. And when were those orchards, or when was that orchard blooming in that 8-day window when we didn't have any activity?
Driving around looking at orchards, Machado said the Sacramento Valley has a reasonable crop, but that area was hit with a devastating freeze last year, and many growers didn't even harvest. Orchards within the San Joaquin Valley are much more variable this season. If he had to guess, Machado said he expects this year's yields to be below the 10-year average of about 2,150 pounds per acre. But he said the industry will get their first look at the size of the expected crop when the USDA releases its subjective almond crop forecast May 12. USDA will follow that with the objective measurement forecast July 8.
You have to remember in the Sacramento Valley last year, they endured the freeze. And there are a significant number of orchards up there that didn't harvest. So, you know, they look much better than last year. But I'd say they're still not up to what some people would call an average. An average is a calculation after the fact. The San Joaquin Valley had a decent crop last year, and it's much more variable. And again, you'll find orchards that are really, really good, literally adjacent to orchards that have virtually nothing in them. So if you wanted to say, is the crop average? No. In my estimation, it is below the 10-year average yield. And forgive me, I don't have that number at the tip of my tongue. I think it's about 2,150 pounds, 2,148 pounds per acre on the 10-year average. So probably not at that level, but it remains to be seen exactly what this crop is. We're all waiting for the subjective estimate that comes out on the 12th of this month, and then we'll wait for July 7th for the objective as well.
Machado said the cold weather definitely has delayed the crop. How much is anyone's guess? Some folks look at nut drop, where the tree sheds excess crop load. Machado himself looks at the first solid nonpareil, and that stage of nut development is still a ways off.
The common thought is that it's about 2 weeks behind. Some people will argue 3 weeks. For me, one metric, and it's a kind of a loose metric, is the shed, what some people call the June drop. It ordinarily occurs at the end of April. It's just getting started now. And ordinarily, about the third week of April, you can tell what's going to come off. So it's late. I always watch the first solid nonpareil. When do I find a nonpareil? And we always find on the west side of the San Joaquin that nut is fully solid. And we're going to be looking for that. But we're a couple of weeks, or at least a few weeks away from that. That'll be the first good metric. And then the hull splat after that.
Almond trees in many areas have yellowish leaves. And Machado said that could be for a number of reasons. The winter rains may have washed away fertilizers. The cold weather slowed nutrient uptake. The rains prevented timely fertilizer applications. And in some cases, he said the trees are succumbing to Phytophthora. A fungal disease, Phytophthora is made worse by standing water. This year, some orchards were flooded for several weeks.
The yellow orchards, and there's a lot of them, and it's all across the valley, you know, several issues. One is we washed a lot of nutrients out of the soil, out of the soil profile. It was difficult to get back on the soil. In fact, it was impossible to really get machinery on the fields to do any fertilization. A lot of fertilizer goes on in liquid forms in the irrigation water, but the grower's thinking, my God, I don't want to add any more water to this. And then there's the question, as cold as the soil was, what's the uptake going to be? How's this stuff going to be taken up and metabolized? Do I have enough roots there? Because we're literally anaerobic in some conditions, some areas. Do I have enough roots and hairs left that I can actually pick this stuff up? That all leads to the yellow orchards. There's definitely some Phytophthora fears out there. I've seen low spots in several orchards in the San Joaquin Stanislaus area that the water stood a little bit more, or even if it didn't stand, it stayed a little more soggy, that the trees are, let's say, dying. They're defoliating. The leaves are very small. Those trees are in trouble. So we're definitely going to see some Phytophthora issues going forward. When we warmed up here a week ago, and I say, gee, a week ago, it was, what, 90-something? Today, it's raining and it's in the upper 50s. When it warmed up, you could see the trees that are in greater stress starting to curl up in trouble. You could also see that there were orchards starting to green up a bit. Things were drying out. People were actually starting to irrigate because they saw that they needed some water. We've used a couple inches of water already. So guys were adding that. And things were looking better. Rain now? Okay, you start worrying about scab and rust. How long is this rain going to last? The forecast is a little damp for the next few days.
The cold, wet weather has set the scene for diseases such as scab. But because the fungicides are protectants, Machado said they should have already been applied. Orchard sanitation also was a challenge this winter. The practice, which involves shaking mummies and then chopping them up on the orchard floor, is a pillar of naval orangeworm control. With many growers not being able to shake, Machado said they'll have to keep a close eye on the pest this season.
I just noted the scab and the rust. That's something that your materials have to be on pre-symptomatic, so those materials need to be going on now or already have gone on. Sanitation this year was really problematic. You couldn't get in. When it started raining, guys just stopped. I know a few people that were able to get in once the rain abated. I was able to shake mine off late in the season before the bloom. But I have a cover crop, and so I blew my strips and blew those mummies into the strip and ground them up when I terminated the cover crop. Joel Siegel will tell you, and I shouldn't put words in his mouth, but he'll tell you that the day-degree accumulations right now are some of the lowest we've seen. So that emergence from those mummies is also commensurately delayed. And as guys are taking those cover crops out, I think if they could get the mummies out and get them in the cover crop, I think they've got the moat up in time. For a lot of people, they couldn't get the mummies out of the trees. So we have to be careful going forward.
The next important almond stage of development is hull split, which typically occurs in late June or early July. Machado said he learned a long time ago not to predict the weather, but he said UC has a hull split calculator that growers can use to give them an idea of when it will occur. It can be found at https://fruits-and-nuts.ucanr.edu/weather_services/almond_hull-split_prediction. Knowing hull split is important to properly time naval orangeworm sprays. If growers don't use a calculator, Machado recommended they pay close attention to the tops of their trees where nuts typically split first.
I learned a long time ago not to predict the weather, but normally you start hull split in the middle of the state, somewhere around the end of June, 1st of July. The university does have a hull split model. Once we get 90 days past peak bloom, growers can go to that and input their weather station, their SEMA site, and it will predict the hull split, and I would encourage people to do that. We could have a weird hull split. We could have a very diffuse hull split. I mean, we don't know what the weather's going to be over the next 2 months, but I will say people should watch their trees carefully, watch the tops of the trees. If you're not going to use that university's hull split prediction model, watch the tops of your trees where those blank nuts split first, and make sure that you're timing any treatments you're using correctly to that split. And it gets even further complicated with the pollinator varieties afterwards.
There's a lot of weather between now and when harvest of the earliest almond varieties begin later this summer. As with every year, Mother Nature holds the cards. We'll see what type of hand she deals growers for the rest of this season. This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced that nearly $130 million in additional automatic financial assistance has been obligated for qualifying farm loan program borrowers who are facing financial risk. The announcement is part of the $3.1 billion to help distressed farm loan borrowers that was provided through Section 22006 of the Inflation Reduction Act. Since the IRA was signed by President Joe Biden in August of 2022, including these payments announced, USDA is providing approximately $1.1 billion in immediate assistance to more than 20,000 distressed borrowers. Through the Inflation Reduction Act, Congress directed USDA to deliver financial assistance to distressed farm loan borrowers as quickly as possible, and that is what they are delivering to help producers across the country stay on their land, according to USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. As consumers are becoming more and more interested in not only where their food comes from, but who the people are behind their food procurement, one company is helping propel the stories of farm workers and produce. THX is a social impact program helping farm workers achieve their dreams. It began 5 years ago where labels on packages of blueberries, cherries, pears, and lemons featured photos of real farm workers with a QR code next to their pictures. Via that code, consumers could watch a one-minute video of a farm worker talking about where they work and what they do. Each worker also has a dream that is related to a need they have. The brand is called THX because they are thanking the consumer for buying the product because it's helping them. That according to Martin Casanova of THX. The dreams fall into one of three categories: education, micro-entrepreneurship, and home improvements. It helps farm workers level up socially, he says, noting the dreams may include anything from supporting their small side business of selling cakes to neighbors to receiving support for learning English and education. Consumers love the concept, according to Casanova, and find the label easy to connect with. He says while many retailers promote farmers, which is great, the focus is on farm workers. A survey earlier this year of 300 consumers confirmed that inkling, with more than 70% of respondents saying they would choose the brand once they fully saw what it was all about. However, the program is not without its hurdles. When you're doing something so different, there are challenges because people aren't looking for it, and it's something totally new, he says. So while convincing retailers of this concept is one hurdle, another is a portrayal of farm workers. Companies wondered, how can you get the emotional connection with consumers without giving the impression that farm workers are poor people and that growers aren't paying fair wages and not covering their needs? After all, as Casanova explains, the companies it works for try to help their farm workers as much as possible. The big problem is that it's seasonal work. Farm workers likely live in small towns and do this work a few months a year, so it's not stable work. In turn, this has meant carefully editing videos to not give consumers the impression that farm workers are poor. Meanwhile, the program is developing, and most recently, THX switched from strictly being a brand to being a program. Since the beginning, they've had growers and companies who like the concept and have asked if they are willing to let them use the concept, but they didn't have a solution for that, he says. After a test run of the program model in Argentina proved to be successful at last fall's IFPA show, it launched a program format. This way it can help more farm workers and they can go beyond what they sell. They are partnering with companies who want to have something to help their brands have a connection with consumers or are looking for a sustainability program to help employees. 3 months ago, it also launched Seeding Futures, the nonprofit aspect of the program. They got emails from consumers wanting to help make the dream happen or companies wanting to help by donating money, but they didn't have anything to offer as all the dreams are paid for by their profit or fees, he says. So Seeding Futures was created. It's an open program helping farm workers and their families in everything related to education. They partnered with a very well-regarded online educational institution, and they provide free online classes to farm workers and their families, says Casanova, noting that these could be English and computer lessons, help for kids with homework, and other school support initiatives. He notes that donating to this program is not required to do business with THX. If you got an ag census questionnaire, even though you are no longer farming, Census of Ag officials are asking you to reply to the questionnaire anyway. USDA Ag News reporter Gary Crawford.
For this current Census of Agriculture, the USDA sent out about 3 million questionnaires to people who have been or might be involved in agriculture. If you are no longer farming, you may have still gotten the questionnaire, but you haven't replied, of course, since you're not farming anymore. However, Jody McDaniel with the USDA Statistics Service asks that you do respond to the census.
It's important, even if someone receives a Census of Ag and while they're working through the form, they no longer are involved in agriculture this year, but they'd had that potential previously, to just go ahead and and return that form and let us know that they're no longer involved in agriculture, because that response is important too, just as much as the individuals who respond to let us know that they have actually still been involved.
He says returning that form will certainly help make the final count of U.S. farmers much more accurate, and he says it's not too late to do that. USDA will be accepting census returns for the rest of the spring. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Farmers ranchers had the opportunity to share what agriculture needs from the next farm bill during a Senate Agriculture Subcommittee hearing. Farm News reporter Michael Clements has more.
Senate Agriculture Committee lawmakers heard from farmers and ranchers during a farm bill hearing Tuesday. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duvall shared with the committee the challenges farmers and ranchers face today.
Like rising interest rates, production expense that keeps increasing year after year, but also told them about the opportunities ahead of us. Agriculture is doing more with less thanks to innovation and research, and our sustainability story is something that we all ought to be proud of as farmers and ranchers. Most importantly, I emphasize the need for strong farm safety net, including crop insurance and the Farm Bill support programs, and the importance of a unified Farm Bill that keeps nutrition programs and farm programs together.
Duvall says there are several investments farmers and ranchers need from the Farm Bill.
We'll need investments into agriculture's research, investment in voluntary incentive-based conservation programs, and investment to ensure those facing hunger have access to nutritious food that farmers are dedicated to producing. All of these investments come through the Farm Bill. But nearly half of all of our Congress has never worked on a Farm Bill process before, and it is more important than ever that farmers and ranchers use their voice to help Congress understand the importance of the Farm Bill.
Duvall says there are several ways to stay involved in the legislative process.
I encourage all farmers and ranchers to reach out to the member of Congress to see if he or she is going to be in their area. Whether it's a listening session or a town hall meeting, our farmers need to be at those meetings and share their story of their farm. If they're not already a Farm Bureau member, I encourage them to join us at our county level and get involved in a grassroots policy making process. That is time well spent as a farmer.
Learn more at fb.org/advocacy. Michael Clements, Washington.
The Biden-Harris administration is announcing investments of more than $36 million in nearly 100 projects to improve water quality, roads, trails, bridges, and fish habitat on national forests and grasslands nationwide. The announcement is part of President Biden's Investing in America agenda and the administration's work to build a clean energy economy while creating economic opportunity in communities across the country, according to the administration. The investments are made possible by President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law, which devotes unprecedented resources to infrastructure improvements. The funds are delivered by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Forest Service through their Legacy Roads and Trails program, which supports 98 projects in fiscal year 2023. The program funds projects along with other restoration and infrastructure work to improve water quality and aquatic habitat while making transportation systems safer, more sustainable, and durable.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.